content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this last episode for September, we'll dig deeper into the issue of Our State Magazine, which this month features articles all about North Carolina's rural roots. Our first article is entitled Bulldog Believers. After more than 70 years, football is back at Barton College, a small liberal arts school in the heart of Wilson County. Now, student-athletes from rural high schools across North Carolina are finding not only a place to play, but also futures beyond sports. Chip Hester had a vision. There were days during that long week back in September 2020 when the thermometer touched 90 degrees and the eastern North Carolina humidity felt thick enough to chew. Hester, the coach of the newly reestablished football program at Barton College in Wilson, drove one tractor, and Todd Wilkinson, the school's director of athletics, drove the other. Barton's first class of 80 football recruits, including 31 uplifted by an improbable legacy they knew nothing about, worked in shifts to plant the sod for a field upon which they would soon practice as a team. Though none of them would put on a game uniform for another year, they were already Bulldogs. Those guys literally laid the foundation of our program with their own sweat equity, Hester says. Fortunately, we'd recruited a bunch of tough country boys who were used to hard work and getting their hands dirty. Many of these country boys had once harbored the same crazy dream, to be the first generation in their families to attend college. At Barton, they would become known as the First Gens. Touring the campus, the entirety of which could be viewed from the peak of the school's four-story bell tower, the initial question becomes obvious. How has this little liberal arts school with barely 1,000 students, on a campus consisting of 8 blocks and 0 stoplights, made such a huge impact? It gives me chills, says Ken Tyler, Barton's vice president and current director of athletics. At this place, you can use a brown oblong ball to chart a completely new path, and those First Gens are the proof. Which begs the question, why Barton? Faith Searcy had a vision. She wanted her children to be the first in her family to attend college. She graduated from Hendersonville High School in 1953 and promptly took a job in the local textile mill where she worked third shift alongside Emerson Searcy, another Hendersonville High School alum just back from the Korean War. One Wednesday afternoon in October of 1953, Faith and Emerson clocked out from work, got married, and then returned to the mill to finish their shift. Emerson left the mill in 1956 for a job at the new General Electric plant and moved the family to a small house in Mountain Home. Faith raised the couple's 4 children and worked as a substitute teacher at Balfour Elementary School. Mom knew it was unlikely that we would have a pathway to college, said Doug Searcy, the youngest of the family's children, but she also understood the value of education, that if her kids wanted more opportunity, she had to take a risk. So one morning in the spring of 1977, shortly after the Searcy's oldest son, Brad, followed his father in getting a job at the GE plant, where their second son, Clift, had worked the previous summer before his senior year at West Henderson High, Faith and Clift made the 40-mile drive to Mars Hill College. This was a dream of mine since childhood and one that I'd prepared for physically and academically for many years, Clift says. Mom insisted that we must knock on the doors and let God open the ones that were meant to be. Faith's faith paid off. When she and Cliff, a 6'3", 235-pound offensive tackle, arrived at the Mars Hill administration's office, a call was promptly placed to Lions football coach Claude Hoot Gibson. Cliff was quickly summoned to Gibson's office. He, Gibson, was impressed with my size and the initiative I had shown, so he offered me a scholarship on the spot, Cliff says. I was walking on clouds. Football Saturdays at Mars Hill became a Searcy family affair. It was the first college campus that the younger children, Mary Beth and Doug, had ever visited. As a 6-year-old kid, I didn't know a lot about college, Doug says, but walking around that campus, I recognized that something important happened here, there, that I was curious about. A decade later, inspired by his brother's college degree, Doug earned academic and leadership scholarships to attend Morris Hill. Doug Searcy had a vision. Hired in 2015 as the president of Barton College, he wanted to offer students a chance to become the first in their families to attend college through football scholarships. One teeny problem. Barton didn't have a football team back then, Hester says. Barton didn't have a football field. I'm not even sure they had a football. The school had dropped its football program in 1950, and 65 years later, it became Searcy's mission to bring it back. He understood the power of Friday night football in eastern North Carolina, and he thought that energy could be translated to Saturday afternoons at Barton. I've always felt a vitality and community engagement around football, says Searcy, who played receiver at West Henderson High. It brings together a bunch of young people and a coach with a goal to achieve something bigger than themselves. Not just wins on the football field, but a goal for graduation and a future. One of my critical selling points to our board was the opportunity to bring in kids from the area who might have no other chance of going to college. When Hester accepted the Bulldogs coaching job in 2018, there wasn't much to sell. He would walk recruits into a parking lot behind the biology building. I told those guys that this is where our game field will be, Hester recalls sheepishly. A lot of our initial recruiting pitch was, you're going to have to use your imagination, but I can envision what was possible. Then it was time to find some cliffs. Jaquan Lynch had a vision. He wanted to be the first in his family to attend college. He just couldn't imagine how. Often during his youth in Rocky Mount, Lynch spent nights with his single mother, Shannon, and his three brothers sleeping on a car parked at the doctor's office where Shannon worked. At Rocky Mount High School, Lynch, who started at quarterback, was a gifted athlete who generated no interest from college football recruiters because he rarely passed the ball in the Griffins' wing T offense. During his senior year in the fall of 2019, Lynch spoke to Army recruiters and took the military aptitude test. I had no college football offers and no hope, he says, until Barton came from nowhere. Lynch wasn't aware that about the same time, Hester had visited Rocky Mountain High to watch football practice. Longtime Griffins coach Jason Battle had told them that Lynch was the highest character kid he'd ever coached. That statement resonated with the coach searching for a cornerstone upon which to build a program. Within days, Hester reached out to Lynch to offer him a scholarship. I committed on the spot, Lynch says. It was a huge sigh of relief, like the world fell off my shoulders. For the first time in my life, I didn't have to worry about how I'd make it through the next day. Lynch started at quarterback for the Bulldogs' first three seasons from 2021 to 23, leading the nascent Division II program to a respectable 16-17 record. During the 23 season, Lynch was one of those first 31 first-gens on Barton's football roster. Young men from little North Carolina towns from Archdale to Zebulon, from Jacksonville, Lawsonville, McLeansville, Reedsville, Rollsville, Kernersville, Beulahville, Whiteville, Statesville, Winterville, and Thomasville. Young men like Edwin Fuentes Berrios from Salisbury, one of seven children of Central American immigrants whose father, Jose, worked the 3 a.m. to midday shift at a produce warehouse. Edwin never considered talking to his parents about college until Barton came from nowhere. At West Rowan Middle School, Fuentes Berrios' assistant principal was Chip Hester's wife, Trish, and their daughter, Tori, was a classmate. Attending his daughter's volleyball games at West Rowan High, Chip Hester first noticed a large, charismatic young man leading the Falcons' student cheering section, a kid who drew praise from Trish and Tori. By his senior year, Fuentes Berrios also attracted Hester's attention as a tackle on the Falcons' offensive line. My parents couldn't wrap their head around it originally, that Barton was offering me a tuition money to play football, Fuentes Berrios says. For me, that scholarship was a game changer. Cameron Johnson began his football career at Northern Nash High School in Rocky Mount as a 5'5", 140-pound quarterback. On the same trip that Hester first scouted Lynch, the coach noticed the small but speedy kid at Northern Nash who could project as a wide receiver. Johnson had joined the ROTC in high school with plans to enlist in the military because he had no scholarship offers until Barton came from nowhere. Barton is one of the few places that offered me tuition money, he says. It was a no-brainer. Lynch, Fuentes Barrios, and Johnson were all there sweating through that blistering week in the late summer of 2020, laying the groundwork for the Barton football program in patches of sod. Sometimes when I'm out in the hot sun painting the lines on that practice field, Hester says, I can't help but think to myself, what is Mac Brown doing right now? There are plenty of reminders that this isn't Division I football. The Barton football offices are located in a former Cadillac dealership on the edge of campus. Team meetings take place in the old showroom, where Hester says it's not uncommon for a film session to be interrupted by a knock on the door from someone inquiring about an oil change for a 1965 Coupe de Ville. But the grand blueprint of Searcy and Hester has come to fruition on football Saturdays. Barton plays home games in a brand new Truist Stadium, where fans can buy a $3 bright leaf red hot dog with chili from a food truck behind the west end zone where the biology students used to park. An average crowd of more than 2,500 showed up for home games during the 23 season, including Shannon Lynch, Jose Fuentes, dozens of Cameron Johnson's family members, and Hester's father, Larry, who is blind but enjoys sitting in the stands listening to games on the radio over the regular train whistle in the background. Cliff Searcy had a vision. He wanted to be a teacher. He graduated from Mars Hill in 1981 as a two-time all-conference offensive tackle, but more importantly to him, cum laude with an English major. Cliff returned home to Rugby Junior High and West Henderson High and taught English for 30 years. Doug and his sister Mary Beth, a mathematics professor at Appalachian State University, each earned doctorates. Both Emerson and Brad eventually retired from GE as its longest-standing employees of their eras. Faith still lives in the family house in Mountain Home. Emerson died in 2011. Fuentes Barrios will graduate from Barton in December with a double major in exercise science and sports management, with aspirations to be a strength and conditioning coach. Johnson graduated with a degree in exercise science, a 5-foot, 10-inch, 185-pound receiver who ran a 4.4-second 40-yard dash in the spring to earn a free agent contract with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. While at Barton, he volunteered as a football coach at Fike High and Wilson and plans to pursue coaching once his playing days are done. Without the opportunity Barton gave me, I don't like to think about where I might be, Johnson says. It's been a blessing that has no doubt changed my life. Lynch earned his B.S. in psychology and currently attends graduate school at Campbell University, with plans to become a clinical mental health counselor, mentoring kids who grew up in challenging circumstances like his own. Just as the Searcy family, Lynch blazed the trail for his younger brother, DeAndre, to attend Old Dominion on a football scholarship. I'm just really grateful for the example that was set for me by all the members of my family, Doug Searcy says. I've thought a lot about my family and our trajectory, and every bit of this mission is personal. But the story doesn't end here. I think about what Cliff accomplished, and I wonder, what will these 31 guys be doing 20 years from now? Our next article is entitled In Search of Down East. In Carteret County, the North River does more than divide the land. It defines a specific once remote region of North Carolina and the distinct culture and traditions that took root there, shaped by sound and sea. Rising slightly above sea level in the eastern edge of North Carolina lies a watery part of the world, trimmed by salt marsh, blanketed in needle rush, and molded with wind-sculpted live oaks. It's the kind of place where sunsets seem more golden and clear days more blue, where light and shadow feel amplified and a hard northwest wind sharper, when the pungent scent of the marsh is as welcome as a gentle southwest breeze. Here, the memory of past storms and the fear of those yet to come are a constant and lasting reminder of Mother Nature's mercy and wrath. A sense of wildness prevails, untamed by the world beyond. Down East Carteret County is more than a gateway to the Cape Lookout National Seashore, a scenic byway, and a wildlife refuge. It's an elegy to wind and tide, an ode to salt and scales. It's a portal to an endangered way of life that persists, somehow, for now. Down East is defined specifically and inextricably by its geography and the relationship with the water. Beginning on the east side of the North River, it meanders over dozens of bridges through incorporated communities bound by Harker's Island to the south and Cedar Island to the north. Betty fades south into Otway, shifts into Straits, curves into Gloucester, meanders to Marshallburg, continues north through Smyrna and on to Williston, inches north and east through Davis, Stacy, sea level, and Atlantic, before terminating at Cedar Island along Pamlico Sound. Protected from the Atlantic Ocean by a chain of barrier islands, the Core Banks, Cape Lookout, and Shackleford Banks, that hem in Core and Bank and Back Sounds, these tiny hamlets are a part of a world on the edge. Down East is carved and buoyed by salt water, a people's deep connection to place, and a fervent pride in their shared heritage and traditions. From boat building and commercial fishing to duck hunting and decoy carving, the rituals of the region trace and tap residents' waterlogged roots to generations of earnest, hardworking, and determined ancestors. Zach Davis switches off the light in his classroom and closes the door to the shop where he teaches marine trades and welding technology at the local high school. He's heading to his other job, the one he was born into. 10 miles down the road, his shrimp trawler, Addie and Dallas, named after his two kids, is tied up on Marshallburg's Sleepy Creek, where Davis was raised. Like most folks down east, his roots run deep. My family on my mama's side is from Shackleford. My great-great-great-grandparents are buried over there, he says. My daddy's side has been on Marshallburg around 10 or 12 generations back. Once they moved to Marshallburg, they never left. I'm living on the same land my ancestors lived on. Davis pulls his pickup into the dirt path in front of the boathouse where he built Addie and Dallas by hand, plank by plank. My great-granddad was a boat builder, and my dad is a boat builder. And I'm not a boat builder, but I did build this one, he says, gesturing to the 56-foot trawler tugging at the dock lines along the bank. Down East's boat building tradition was born out of necessity. In a time where before bridges and roads, wherein water was the highway, boats were a lifeline connecting communities and transporting people and supplies. They were a means by which to make a living, too. Pole skiff and sail sharpies evolved into gas-powered round sterns and iconic flare bow boats. Every community down east was, at one time, home to a master boat builder. Under a canopy of live oaks, somewhere close to the shore, men built boats from wood by the rack of the eye, using an innate sense of engineering to blend balance and design without blueprints as they imparted function, art, and part of themselves into every vessel. Granddaddy always said, you ought to set up one in the backyard and build it. Just take your time to do it. A couple of years ago, he said, what the heck, let's give it a shot, Davis says. 2.5 years after he cut the first piece of wood, Addie and Dallas was lowered into Sleepy Creek. But the boat was a means to an end. In the same way that boat building runs in Davis's blood, so does commercial fishing. As a kid, I'd see these big shrimp trawlers coming by from Harker's Island, he says. Every evening they'd come by, and every morning at daylight they'd come back. The more I looked at them, the more I thought, if I just had one of them, I'd be set. He started shrimping when he was 12 and has never stopped. Now it's the clock by which his life revolves. In the summer, shrimping drives whatever I do, day and night. It all depends on how they're running, the moon cycle, and what kind of season you're having. Over the past generation, fish houses have shuttered one after the other, leaving North Carolina's seafood industry in peril. Work boats are being replaced by recreational vessels, pound and channel nets by rods and reels. Now more than ever, fishing as a way of life down east hinges on the commitment of folks like Davis who keep the work boats working, embrace their heritage proudly, and share the bounty of our pristine waters with people across the state and beyond. There's nothing better than a day shrimping, Davis says. Come out of Beaufort Bar about daylight, pointer toward the lighthouse. About the time it drops off, 40 to 45 feet, is when you want to slow down. You let the rigs down and set out. Take her right into the sunlight, run her straight toward the sun. He gestures toward an imaginary horizon. When you get down about to Whale Creek, turn around and come back to the eastern side of the bar. Then you just go to and fro all day. There's just nothing better. We're very fortunate. We live in a blessed place. There's no question. Down the road from Zach Davis, the shed behind Corey Lawrence's home in Otway looks like it could be a lot of things, part museum, part workshop, part garage, but it's where he unveils, sliver by sliver, a redhead or pintail decoy buried in the block of sweet-smelling tupelo or juniper. For Lawrence, born and raised on Harker's Island, decoy carving is a love and a calling that has defined his family for generations. Duck hunting's always been part of my life, he says. I grew up in a living room lined with decoys and sprinkled with wood shavings. My dad would sit in the living room with a newspaper across his lap and carve out heads to repair broken decoys so we could hunt. Like boat building and commercial fishing, waterfowling is a time-honored cornerstone of life down east, past and present. Situated along the Atlantic Flyway, Coeur Sound's expansive water and extensive marsh attracts a bevy of ducks, geese, and swans each winter. Once essential for survival, today they are hunted for both sustenance and sport. When Lawrence was 12, he needed to earn his woodworking merit badge for scouts. He points to a row of little black and white decoys lined up on a shelf. The simplest thing I knew to do would be to carve a little buffalo head, he said. They're little and not very colorful. His father handed him a pocket knife and a block of wood. That moment, Lawrence's first decoy was a sacrament, a nourishing of destiny. Out of a block of tupelo, a rudimentary decoy was born, and a passion was lit, inherited from his father and now passed on to Lawrence's children. Before the 80s in Coeur Sound, decoys were pragmatic tools meant to lure waterfowl. That changed in 1987 when Lawrence's father, David, and six other island carvers laid the foundation for the Coeur Sound Decoy Carvers Guild and the first Coeur Sound Decoy Festival. Today, the Coeur Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center has ensured the preservation and perpetuation of an almost lost art. David's room at the museum is a living testament to the Lawrence's heritage, a place where in David's spirit demonstrations are held and carvers gather in fellowship to reaffirm the community's identity ingrained in decoys. Over the past 30 years, this newfound recognition transformed Coeur Sound decoys from an everyday utilitarian tool into a highly collectible and valuable folk art. More than that, though, decoys are a reminder of the ancestors who carved them and those who hunted over them. They are a spiritual connection to the past and a way to continue family traditions. Today, as Lawrence passes down the practice to his sons and daughters, it's a history that honors a new generation of carvers, tapping an innate gift. Some of my earliest memories are of my daddy taking me hunting, Lawrence says. There were times it would be cold and miserable, but bless his heart, he'd want me to be with him so bad. I remember he'd towed a sack of decoys in one hand and his old Mossberg shotgun in the other, and I'd be on his back with a BB gun. He'd trudge through a marsh somewhere just to sit and spend time with me. Tears well in his eyes. When he speaks of his dad, the loss is palpable, a wound every bit as tender today as when it first opened in 2001. I wish I could spend another day like that. I do the same thing with my kids. It's not as much about the decoys or the hunting as it is time with family and friends. Decoys are memories made material, a way of holding on to what matters most. They conjure dark winter mornings when marsh grass is imprisoned in thin sheets of ice and breath hangs in vanishing little clouds. They are the fading of stars as the sun breaks the horizon and the sound of wings flapping in the wind. They are crimson heads cast against a gray sky. They are the smell of gunpowder and ringing in the ear. Decoys are moments shared from reed-covered duck blind, shoulder to shoulder with the people you love, made tangible. Like other rural, remote coastal communities, the only constant down east is change. Its relative isolation has been its preservation, but today the word from off creeps closer and closer. The sound of the distinct Outer Banks brogue becomes fainter with each generation. Fewer wooden workboats idle in the sound. As development encroaches and property values appreciate, fewer generational families can afford to inherit property. Local stores close. Chains fill their void. Each year it becomes harder and harder to make ends meet by fishing for a living. With limited employment opportunities, young people face moving off, raising the question, who will ensure the traditions of Down East continue? But the Core Sounders are no strangers to challenges, and they rise to hardship as a collective. Among the cornerstones of Down East, perhaps none is greater than community. Those who call this region home are strong, self-reliant, sturdy people. They weather life's setbacks and nature's storms together. Like their ancestors, they hold close to one another, reminding each other of who they are and the bonds they share, determined to ensure that future generations will inherit the legacy of being from and of Core Sound. The kinship to the place and each other is sacred, as constant as the swaying of marsh grass, as reliable as the primordial smell of the marsh, as true as the live oaks anchored in shifting sands. We'll wrap it up with an article about Mount Pleasant called Little Flower on the Prairie. With its mustard yellow petals and narrow leaves, velvety on one side and rough on the other, the Schweitzer's sunflower has an unassuming appearance. Nevertheless, Sean Bloom gets giddy every time he sees one. These federally endangered flowers serve as a bellwether for the health of Buffalo Creek Preserve in Mount Pleasant. This flower needs these open grasslands, which are rare because of its development, but it used to be more common in the Piedmont, Carolina, says Bloom, land stewardship director for Catawba Land Conservancy, Carolina Thread Trail. It took 10 years of prescribed burns and targeted herbicide treatments to return the 80-acre property, which had been clear-cut for a defunct housing development, to its prairie roots. Only then did it become fertile ground for the Schweinitz sunflower. The project to save the flower began in the fall of 2020 when five volunteers collected seed heads from nearby roadside population to plant. Anytime we can get them off a roadside into a protected spot where they won't be affected, that's preferred, Bloom says. The seed heads were sent to the North Carolina Botanical Garden in Chapel Hill, where they were dried out and propagated into 800 plants. In one day, volunteers planted the seedlings in 100-foot rows in full sunshine and partial shade. By fall of 2022, 180 stems survived, and in 2023, there were 215 stems. By protecting the habitat for the Schweinitz sunflower, the conservancy also is attracting other plants, such as the Carolina birdfoot trefoil, shrub and weed nesting birds like the indigo bunting, and pollinating insects, including monarch butterflies, all signs of life that thrive alongside a rare yellow flower. In the early 1800s, Salem resident Louis Davis von Schweinsit, a Moravian clergyman and respected botanist, discovered what would become his namesake sunflower. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. It can be reached at 919-781-1973. If you have any questions or comments, call us at the Reading Service at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.